Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. For this episode, we are discussing soil health. Homer Soil and Water Conservation District's Jessica Sharp shares information about the process of soil testing and how a plant might alert us to nutrient deficiencies. Soil scientist for the state NRCS office, Dennis Mulligan, explains soil health as well as soil mapping and the physical, chemical, and biological aspects of the soil, as well as how we can encourage soil biodiversity. And Nicole Arevalo has your weekly roundup of events and opportunities in local agriculture. For this episode, we are talking about soil, but first I want to talk about pie. That's right, pie. I went into a bit of a rabbit hole for this, but I assure you, this journey is worth the payoff. For the purposes of this explanation, I'm not talking about pie from a pizzeria or a bakery, nor am I talking about pie 3.14159, etc. I am talking about what linguists, or people that study language, abbreviate as PIE. It stands for Proto-Indo-European. In the same way that animals share evolutionary ancestors, language follows similar patterns. Like a trunk of a tree with many branches and offshoots, Proto-Indo-European is the trunk of a large language tree. It is estimated that there are over 445 living languages with Proto-Indo-European roots. The English words I'm speaking now can be traced to this language. These words share commonalities with words in Hindustani, Russian, Punjabi, Persian, Germanic and Slavic languages, and all of the Romance languages. Romance languages is just another way of saying Latin-based languages. Many people know Latin as a dead language, meaning that there are no living speakers, but Proto-Indo-European language predates Latin and carries a different distinction. It is a theoretical language. Scholars can speculate on its existence only because of the similarities and comparisons to later languages. It is postulated to have emerged during the Neolithic era. Lithic, meaning stone, the New Stone Age, approximately 10,000 to 2000 BCE. This is also during the period that agriculture emerged. What can we learn about being human from these early word origins? Let's use the word human as an example, which has a Proto-Indo-European root, dehemon. That pronunciation is purely speculative and based on several YouTube videos that I watched. This root literally means of the earth. As humans, we are, even within the context of word origins, linked to the earth. This concept is much easier for me to explain using Latin. Human, from the Latin humus, which gardeners and soil scientists might recognize as a layer of the soil. In Latin, humus means of the earth or of the soil. In addition to the word human, there are several common words that share this etymology. The word humility and the word humiliate, both signifying a closeness to the ground, one having a positive connotation, the other negative. Humility is typically a place that you put yourself, while humiliation is usually something inflicted to another person. We also encounter this in the word posthumous, meaning after the ground. The late poet's work was published posthumously. We see it in the word exhume, to dig up something that was buried. If you need more evidence of humans' connection to the soil, you can find it easily within creation myths. While some creation myths have unique stories about humans' origins, such as humans being birthed from a god's sweaty left armpit or the lice of a giant's hair, most imagine humans emerging from the soil. People are familiar with the Judeo-Christian myth of Adam. In Genesis 2, God forms Adam out of the dust of the ground. The name Adam is derived from Hebrew, the word adama, which means ground. Variations on this story are found in many cultures. In the Quran, in Surah 23, God created man from clay. In Sumerian mythology, the gods Aniki or Anil created man to be servants for the gods out of clay and blood. In the Babylonian creation myth, the Anuma Elesh, the goddess Ninhursag, created humans from clay. In Greek mythology, Prometheus molded men out of water and earth. The Maori people of New Zealand believed that the god of the forest created the first woman out of clay and breathed life into her. The Yoruba people of Nigeria believed that the god Abatala created the human race from soil. In Incan mythology, the god of everything, Wiracocha, created humans from soil. And there are many, many more myths from all over the world. But I'm moving on because this is a 1-hour show. Which brings me to the point. If I am human and therefore literally of the earth, if I work the dirt and eat the food that I and my neighbors grow, if one day, hopefully years and years from now, my body returns to the ground, how could I ever fully separate myself from the soil? The health of the soil and the health of the land are my own health.
Hi, my name is Jessica Sharp. I work for the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, and most of my job is to analyze soil samples and provide recommendations to local gardeners and farmers.
How did you first become interested in soil?
So I went to school for natural resources management. My emphasis was mostly on forestry, but as you start getting into forest ecology, you realize how important the soils are and how everything is kind of linked through the soils, which got me interested in it. And then when I started working for the conservation district, they have a big emphasis on soil health and preventing erosion. And so I started working more and more with that.
You had mentioned one aspect of your job is soil samples. And I'm wondering what a soil sample can tell us.
So the soil samples can tell us a lot of different things. The most important part is what the nutrient levels are in your soil, which will tell you what kind of fertilizer you need to use. And they can also tell us what the pH of the soil is and how much organic matter you have in your soil.
Are there any trends that you notice with the soil samples from the Homer area? Or from this area in general?
in general, it seems like you guys actually have pretty good soil down there. You've got high organic matter, which is a good thing, and a lot of Alaska doesn't have that. So they tend to be productive soils. Overall, a lot of people do a good job managing the nutrients in their soil, but we do tend to see quite a bit of over-fertilization and some salt buildup. A lot of times people think that more is better with fertilizer, and sometimes you can get to have too much, and that can cause problems with your crops.
The salts are in the fertilizer. Is that where this buildup of salt comes from?
Yeah, and certain kinds of fertilizer have more salts than others.
So you're saying that one of the trends is that people have more, they're putting more things in their garden. But what are some things that people would need to put in that they might be lacking?
Okay, so just really commonly, almost every season, you do need to add nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So a lot of the farmers like to use organic amendments. Common source of nitrogen is blood meal, and a lot of times for phosphorus, we recommend bone meal. The best organic source I've found so far of potassium is called langbeinite, and those are the three most common things that we recommend for nutrients that your crops are going to need every year.
Besides the physical properties of the soil and the chemical properties of the soil, do you know anything about the biological properties in the soil? Like what
I
kind
do a
of
little bit. Yep.
microbes and things that we might find in our soil here?
So soil has a lot more living component than anybody thinks that it does. It has a huge amount of life inside of it, and you have bigger organisms like the worms and beetles and things like that, all the way down to organisms that are too small to see. That life within the soil is extremely important for the health of the soil, but also for growing plants. So if you, say, have a piece of soil and you come in and you just plow it up and you till it up and you keep tilling it over and over and over again, it can harm the life in the soil and just make it very difficult for it to survive because it gets dried out and it gets broken apart and things like that. So a lot of times you'll see people recommending practices that help the soil life to thrive. And these are things like minimizing tillage, keeping a cover on the soil, so mulching and things like that, adding certain type of amendments that help the biology to do better. A lot of times organic fertilizers are gentler on the microorganisms, and some of the really strong conventional fertilizers like urea and things like that tend to be a little harsher on the microbiome.
When you get your soil sample test back and it gives you this list of all these nutrients that you have a lot of or are lacking, what are some of the roles that those individual nutrients have? Like, say, maybe nitrogen.
That's a good question. So nitrogen tends to be for all of the leafy growth of a plant. So it helps them to grow tall and to grow more leaves on them. Phosphorus is particularly important for fruiting and flowering. And potassium is just sort of the overall plant health, is what we like to think of. Some of the other more minor nutrients show up in overall plant health. So if you were to be lacking in a certain thing, then you might start to see problems occurring. For instance, if you had really low boron in your soil, then sometimes there's a problem that can occur where your crops get malformed and they have hollow stems or they have other deformities caused by that. So usually we recommend testing your soil either in the spring or in the fall. You don't really want to test it in the middle of the season because any fertilizer that you applied will be actively going into the soil, and there's just so much going on that it's changing a lot. And so you either want to get a baseline at the beginning of the season or at the end of the season. And we're getting really close to the beginning of the season right now. So if people want to get a soil test before they grow their crops for the season, then they should get it in as soon as possible.
What's the procedure and the process for a soil test?
You should identify which different areas you want tested separately. So, you know, if you have a high tunnel and then you have an outdoor garden, then you would want to test those two things separately. And it's best if you get about 10 samples from each area going down about 6 to 8 inches and then mix those together. And that ensures that you're not going to get unrepresentative sample because, you know, one area might have gotten more fertilizer or has more compost or something, and it might mess it up if you only take your sample from one spot. So take it from a bunch of different areas, then mix it together, and then they can be dropped off at the office. And you can either fill out a paper form, or the easiest thing to do is to fill it out on our website, and you can also pay online that way.
What happens after I get the soil test back? How long does it take? And then what should I do moving forward?
So it usually takes 2 to 3 weeks. And the reason for that is because first we collect all the samples that have been dropped off at the office once a week and ship them to the laboratory. And then once they get to the lab, we use Brookside Labs. Once it gets there, then they dry them and sieve them and analyze them. And once they have that, the data gets emailed directly to me. So then once I get all of that data in, then I can write the recommendation and give it out to people. But like as of right now, I've got a huge amount of data because a lot of people are doing their soil tests. And so then sometimes there's another delay of me having to get to it since I have so many of them. But you should expect your results within 3 weeks. If it takes longer than that, definitely contact us.
Do you know anything about the testing process?
You mean the soil analysis?
Yes.
I know a little bit just from my soils class that I took in college, but I know that it's pretty complex and they do a lot of different laboratory tests to find out all of the information. Some of the tests are relatively easy and others require a lot of steps and different chemicals and things like that.
If I have last year's plants that have died and they're just in the field, should I leave them there? Should I till them in? Should I take them out and put them in a compost pile? How do I clean up, I guess?
So it depends on what's left. If there's anything that you can see that it's got some sort of pathogen or fungus on it, then I would remove that from the field. But if it's just regular healthy plant matter, then you can either till it in or compost it and then incorporate it back in the soil as compost.
And so besides soil testing, are there any other programs that Homer Soil and Water Conservation is doing in relationship to soil health?
We actually have a new study that's just going to be starting this summer. And it's funded through NRCS, and it's a statewide variety trial for cover crops. So these are different crops that you can grow usually towards the end of the season after you've already produced your main crop, or say you're trying to prepare a garden to be more productive, then you would use a cover crop. And a lot of times they're also used to prevent soil erosion too. So they're pretty versatile crops, but we don't have a whole lot of data on them for Alaska. So people will just kind of pick a variety that they heard might work, but they're not sure about it and they're not sure how to manage it. And so what we're going to be doing is testing, I believe it's like 24 different varieties of plants to see which ones do best in Homer's climate. And then that way we'll be able to have this list and say which ones are the most successful. And then farmers can find out that information and it'll make it easier for them to use cover crops in their own fields.
Are there currently many farmers in the Homer area using cover crops?
I know several of them are, but I'm not sure how widespread it is.
Is there anything else that you would like to say?
I've got one other just little tidbit that people might be interested in. Just for any landowner who might be interested in what type of soil they have on their property, you can go online to Web Soil Survey, and it's fairly self-explanatory. It's a little bit complicated, especially if you're not used to using computers or mapping, but I think most people could figure out, it kind of walks you through the process. And if you go to Web Soil Survey, you can get your very own free soil map of your property.
Well, thanks so much and have a great day. Okay. Have fun with your kiddos.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
Have a good one. Bye.
And that was Jessica Sharp from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, recorded May 18th, 2021. Coming up next, we talk to Dennis Mulligan, a soil specialist with the USDA NRCS State Office.
My name is Dennis Mulligan, and I am a soil scientist with the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Can you talk a little bit about soil health and how your organization promotes soil health?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so often when we're working with people out in the public, when we talk about soil, they look at you and they go, oh, it's just dirt, right? Like it's this inert medium that we rototill up, throw some seeds in, sprinkle it with some water and some fertilizer, and that's it. You know, but in reality, soil is a really complex system of mineral components, organic material, chemistry, all the living organisms, and open spaces that allow the movement of air and water. You know, the USDA, the agency that I work for, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, has identified soil health as one of its primary concerns. Soil health is defined by the agency is the capacity of soil to function as a vital living ecosystem that sustains plants and animals and humans. So when we talk about soil health, really only living things can have health. So viewing soil as this breathing, living ecosystem, you know, it's kind of a new way of viewing soils. We at the NRCS have identified these four main management principles to help us to protect and improve our soil health. Number one, we want to minimize the amount of soil disturbance. This might include like low or no-till cropping systems. Number two, we want to maximize the amount of soil cover. The NRCS has a lot of different management practices to achieve this. This might include residue management, so the leftovers from last year's crop, cover cropping, mulching, and so on. We want to maximize the biodiversity. This means the biodiversity both above the ground in the plant strata and below the ground in the roots, and the microbes and so forth, and even macro animals, earthworms and beetles and mites and such that are down there. And then we also want to maximize the presence of living roots. And again, this one's a little tougher in Alaska because of our very short growing season. Typically in the lower 48, you know, the farmers would go out, harvest their crops, then they'd put on a cover of, say, winter rye or something like that. We very often don't have time to do that as we're harvesting right up into the freeze season. But in the state, we do have a number of trials going on where we're trying to kind of perfect the methodology for that. And so this soil health is sort of the principles that would help bring soil back to what its more natural and more healthy, more productive state would be, instead of just sort of the burned out growth medium that a lot of the say the Great Plains soils are becoming.
And so what are some things that are actually living in the soils that we have here in Alaska?
Oh gosh, well, a lot of them. So we have the microbes are, you know, I mean, there's tens of thousands of varieties, maybe hundreds of thousands of varieties, you know, in big groups. There's all kinds of fungus, there's all kinds of bacteria, algae, and then there's, of course, insects, earthworms, beetles, ants, and mites, and just all sorts of things are in there.
A little bit broader question. What made you first get into studying soils? What keeps you interested in them as well?
So when I went to college, which was a long time ago, I wanted to be a geologist. I was really into rocks. I was into rocks from since I was a little kid. So I went to school and I started out majoring in geology. And as I was talking to my advisors and guidance counselors and things like that along the way, you know, it became apparent that at that particular time, to get a good job in geology, you were going to have to get a PhD, and most likely you were going to go to work either in someplace in Southeast Texas or someplace in Alaska in the oil fields, basically running seismic lines and finding oil for the big gas and oil companies. And I didn't think spending that much time in school sounded like a great idea, and it didn't sound like a very exciting job. So I started looking around the university that I was at, and soil science seemed at least related. And so I started taking a couple of classes and did pretty good in it and got interested and have been doing that now for 31 years or so. It just continues to be interesting, mostly because it's a lot of things, right? It's the soil microbiology. It's the lithology that the soil itself is formed in. It involves itself in a lot of different sciences. And that's, I guess, that kind of dynamics just keeps me really interested in it.
Lithology, is that just the study of rocks?
Yes.
So what are some of the programs that the USDA works on involving soil health, or what are some of the programs that you are personally involved in?
We have a soil health initiative, which if you were interested in, you as either a farmer, or I don't know that we haven't really done a lot of it with just gardeners per se, but if you're a farmer and you're interested in this, you can sign up for the soil health initiative, and then we would come out and do a sort of a soil health assessment of what exists on your place on that particular field at that time. And then we would be able to recommend different planting techniques to be able to improve that, you know, so whether it's reduced tillage, whether it's residue management, just a whole variety of different things to help the soil health along, to help build that organic matter in the soil, to increase the biodiversity and the microbes and that sort of thing.
So I have some soil science 101 questions that I was hoping that you could answer. So yes, there's physical, chemical, and biological components of the soil. So what are some of the physical components of the soil that we have here?
Okay, so the physical components, of course, probably the biggest physical component, of course, is what's the soil made of? And we typically break that down into the mineral component, which is, you know, the sand, silt, and clay-sized particles, the sand being the coarsest, the clay being the finest, and then particularly at the surface where humans are interacting with it, there is a small component of that's the organic matter. As far as soil scientists, some other things that we describe is the soil color. We have a specific book that has color chips in it, so we can actually describe specifically what color the soil is, right? So if you just said it was brown, well, brown can be a pretty wide range of things, but we can very specifically describe which brown it is, which can tell a soil scientist, you know, what minerals are in there, maybe how much organic matter is in there, how much weathering has occurred to those particular minerals, that sort of thing.
How about the chemical properties of the soil?
Chemical properties, we measure quite a few of those. We measure, of course, the pH right away. That's one of the most important ones. But we also measure the electrical conductivity, which is going to tell us about how much, you know, what types of salts might be involved in the soil. So kind of going with what, you know, physical and chemical together, some of the colors, whether they're very brightly colored reds and browns and things like that versus sort of the grays and things will tell us about the chemical state or the redoxymorphic state of the soil. So whether it's very low in oxygen, it'll be gray or maybe sometimes blue in color. And if it's high in oxygen, it'll be those bright reds or browns or things like that that you would associate, say, with like rust or something.
Redoxymorphic refers to the oxygen levels?
Yes, the reduction of iron or the oxidation of iron basically is what that term means. Getting a little too...
Oh, I love it.
Okay.
So when you're talking about the color of the soil, I think that in my head I have this image of maybe a movie or something, somebody digging into the ground, getting a handful of like a black dirt and saying something like, that's really rich soil. Can you tell by the color of the soil that if it is a soil that's healthy or high in nutrients?
Yes, good dark soil quite often is, because of the organic matter, is really rich. Decomposed organic matter, if you ever looked at a compost heap or whatever, is black or very, very dark brown or gray. And that usually does indicate that it's really good soil. However, in Alaska, one of the things that was kind of interesting, we were working down near the city of Seward, and all of the rocks there are really, really black. So all of the soils were really, really black. Even the very, very young ones, even though there wasn't a lot of organic matter in them at all. So
so in the last interview, we were talking with someone here in Homer about sort of the macronutrients in the soil. So the NPK values, so nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about micronutrients and what they give to the soil and what their role is in plant health.
Right. So there's a whole slew of different macro and micronutrients, of course. Yeah, the N, P, and K, so the nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. But plants themselves require additional nutrients. Gosh, I mean, ever from manganese, iron, calcium, sulfur, boron to some degree. You know, I mean, so there's a whole slew of different ones. And, you know, I mean, they are important, just like you take a multivitamin, you know, every day, you know, and that's providing your body with the different little nutrients. You know, you're getting the vast majority of the nutrition you need from your food, right? So you're getting all the big proteins and the big carbohydrates and all of those kinds of things from the food you're taking. But, you know, in order to have all of your joints and all of your body parts work correctly, you know, having these little milligrams of whatever that B nutrient or, you know, whatever vitamin or mineral it is that you're taking that supplement for, it just helps everything run just that little bit better. And Alaskan soils, just like all other soils, do provide those nutrients for the different plants. Of course, in different places, those micronutrients in, you know, in too high of volumes can also become toxic. I think of like boron, for instance. In the olden days, I'm not sure if some people still do this, but you could use borax laundry soap to kill the weeds in your sidewalk or wherever you didn't want the weeds to grow, just because it would add too much boron to the soil. And then the plants would be like, oh, that's now boron's toxic.
In the previous interview, Jessica mentioned boron and the buildup of mineral salts.
Well, that I can see for sure. Most gardeners, right, are watering from their garden hose, which may or may not be from a municipal water source. If it is from a municipal water source, then, well, I guess any water source really is, you know, you're not watering with pure water. There is other things dissolved in it. And so, yes, there is the potential there for accumulation of different soluble salts.
Another general soil question. What is humus? HUMS?
Yep, humus is the, it's part of that organic material that exists in the soil. Typically, it is the very highly decomposed organic material. All right, so you might have something like, say, at the surface of the ground, you've got the leaves, or maybe the residue, if you're out on an agricultural field, right, the residue from last year's crop, right? It's stalks and stems and leaves, and that's sort of the duff layer. And then over time, all those microbes, right, the fungus and the bacteria and the earthworms and everybody, they break that down. And as they break it down, and it becomes more and more humified, right? It's now it can like leach down into the soil and form a nice dark surface horizon. So that's that really highly decomposed organic matter that gets, right down into the soil and enriches it. And that's the part that actually is, makes the nutrients and things like that available to plants as well.
So, carbon is something that plants need. And a lot of people talk about, in terms of climate change mitigation, they talk about carbon sequestration. I want to know the role of carbon in the soil.
Well, it's got a huge role in a lot of things. I mean, it's probably the main driving energy force in the soil. In other words, it's a major food for both the plants and all of the microbes that are living there. But it also is sort of the main thing that makes up the organic matter in the soil. And that organic matter drives so much in the soil. I mean, it drives the nutrient exchange in the soil. In other words, there's a lot of little sites on individual or organic matter particles that exchange food and gases with the plants that are existing there. It helps the soil to build soil structure, which are the natural aggregates of individual soil particles. So those individual sand silts and clays then aggregate together, and that organic matter kind of binds them together. And having good soil structure helps promote, good aeration and good drainage of the soil, good tilth. So yeah, carbon is one of the big drivers of all of that.
When we talk about plants are taking these nutrients from the soil. Are they giving anything back to the soil?
Oh, absolutely. The plants themselves have waste materials, right? So some of it is going out, in an exchange through the roots, but then, the plants themselves either eventually die and then their remains become part of that whole carbon cycle. And then, in the terms of things that are very long lived, say like trees and stuff like that, they're dropping their needles and leaves and stuff like that, which are all going into part of that nutrient cycle as well. So yeah, absolutely. They're not just taking, they are giving back as well.
What is mycorrhizae?
Mycorrhizae are a type of fungus that particularly live along the roots of vascular plants, and they kind of help the plant exchange gases and waste materials for the things that it needs to uptake. So, the water and the gases from the soil and the nutrients from the soil.
What are some ways to encourage biodiversity? Is it just planting a variety of different plants in your garden?
Well, I mean, I guess one of the things is, yeah, so again, trying to reduce that tillage as much as possible, right? I mean, when you go in there and rototill or plow up your farm field or rototill your garden and things like that, that's really disruptive to the microbes, but it also sort of infuses the soil with a whole bunch of oxygen all at one time, which like really wakes them up. and they go into hyper mode. So if they're working at that breakneck speed, then with all that oxygen, and they are using up all of that organic matter that's there, right? They're consuming it and burning it off, just what we say, oxidizing it all off. Eventually, then you're going to deplete their food source because they eat it all up at, you know, so quickly. The other thing is, keep maintaining some kind of a good cover, whether it's living plants would be the best, but even leaving the stubble and the residue from previous crops. And what this does is this actually just adds a little layer of protection to the surface of the ground that will help to reduce evaporation of the moisture that's already in your soil. The residues and the cover are eventually going to break down, feeding that pool of carbon that's in the soil. And then planting a variety of different crops, or different, having a variety of different kinds of plants, they're encouraging all the different microbes in the soil. If you were to go out and just plant monoculture, and I'll use potatoes, it's an easy example, right? If you just plant potatoes, and you plant potatoes year after year after year, if you're going to grow potatoes, you're going to have to till. I mean, potatoes are just, they're a high tillage crop. We all love potatoes. You're probably going to grow them. You don't grow them in the same spot year after year after year, because eventually diseases will start, and those diseases are caused by certain kinds of microbes, right? So you've got the things that cause scab and a number of different other potato diseases. So, you know, you move your potato plot around your garden or wherever you're planting them to reduce the amount of potato, whatever the potato scab bug or virus is in the soil. All those different microbes, you know, some of them are good, some of them are bad, you know, some of them are considered good, some of them are considered bad, but having a wide variety of them just creates a better microbial ecology, right? Because there's certain microbes that attack and reduce the number of those bad ones. And some things that are bad for some plants are not necessarily so bad for other plants. Some microbes are absolutely necessary for the plant growth. You know, you think about, like, legumes are nitrogen fixers. Well, that's because they've got a little symbiotic relationship with other microbes that form root nodules on those, either, you know, peas or vetch or whatever legume we're talking about. They grow these little root nodules that attract and fix nitrogen in the soil. Nitrogen typically wants to just off gas and go up into the air, but these particular plants with their microbial partners help to bring that nitrogen in and fix it in the soil, so then other plants can use it.
So are you saying that it's not the peas themselves, it's the microbes that grow on the pea roots? Is that what I'm
hearing? It's that symbiotic relationship, yeah.
Are you a gardener?
You'd think for a person who's been in the soil business for over 30 years would just be a real pro at growing plants and stuff, but I'm really not. I do garden, and I garden poorly. Most of my career has really been involved around mapping soil and looking at those relationships of, you know, on landscapes and, like I say, the lithology and all that kind of business, and little of it. I've only recently been shifted over to sort of the agricultural end of it. Yeah, like I say, my career, I've been more concerned with soil interpretations as they pertain to, like, building roads, or would this support a septic tank, or, you know, a lot of those kinds of things.
Well, I'll ask this question anyway, but if you don't know it, then it's understandable.
Yep.
From what you just said. Let's say I have a plot of land that's untouched, as far as I know, and I want to build a garden plot, like a small garden plot. What would I do? I mean, what would you recommend?
You're going to have to clear it. You're going to, you know, get the root, you know, the tree roots and things like that out of it. And you're probably going to till it up really good the first time to get a good seed bed and all that kind of business. And then after that, you know, what we would say is, you know, like, probably don't go in and do the rototiller type of thing every year. Establish, you know, hopefully maybe some kind of a cover crop. What does that look like? In agriculture, we use a lot of different things, different mixes and things like that. So you could have something like oats and barley, and that would be mixed with like a pea and maybe some kind of a big daikon radish or something like that, that's going to really grow a big gigantic root and sort of break up the soil material. And then you would mow it, don't till it, right? You just mow that down and leave everything there and then plant right into that stubble. But what that looks like for, say, a gardener, and even in Alaska, it's a little bit hard because we don't have that sort of end of the growing season period that where something is going to sprout again, right? A lot of times we in Alaska, we're harvesting our potatoes and our carrots and things like that already when there's frost, right? I mean, there's already frost forming when we're going in and like doing our fall harvest. So it's a really difficult thing to cover here. And so we're kind of trying to come up with different schemes, whether it's, you know, a sort of a low growing cover that we maintain over the ground that the crops can just be planted directly into, whether it's interseeding where you have like an early season crop that you plant early on, and then as that starts to come up, then you plant another crop in amongst it, where, you know, so you've got these two different ages of crops that you can go in and harvest one and still have plant cover carried into the late fall and maybe even winter type of thing. So a lot of things where maybe, you know, a traditional farming sequence would be like growing potatoes for a couple of years and then fallowing the field for a year, in which case the farmers would typically, for weed reduction and things like that, they would just till it up and they'd leave it bare for a year or so as their fallow year. I'm sitting here in the middle of Palmer where, you know, the wind can be whipping by at 80 miles an hour sometimes, nice, good Palmer Matanuska gust, right? And that's just going to carry off all of your topsoil. I talked to one farmer who, he basically said every spring he just comes in and goes to his farthest fenced row and like has to pull all of his soil out of it, just piles up at his fence, and he has to basically rescatter it across his field because everything's just been blowing like crazy all winter long. So we do really need to maintain something on top of that soil in order to just reduce the losses from just wind erosion.
The last person I interviewed said that I should ask you about soil mapping and the USDA's involvement in that.
Yeah, so that is what I have done for most of my career is soil mapping. And we do have quite a large soil mapping program in Alaska. So most of the roaded area in the state has been completed. So of course, the Kenai down where you guys are at, Anchorage, the Matanuska-Susitna Valleys, the Copper River Basin's all been done, all the country up by Delta and Fairbanks and on towards Nenana have all been completed. And then we're working on some larger sort of wildland surveys currently. There's a whole bunch of them now. There's some big ones down by Dillingham and over in the Togiak, say, Wildlife Refuge. There's a big one down, not on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, but just inland from the Delta. Just finished a big one in the Yukon Flats and are finishing one up on the uplands in between, say, Fairbanks and the Yukon Flats. So, I mean, we've got some really big projects at multiple different scales and intensity of use, say.
And these maps just tell people what type of soil is found in a particular location?
Right. They'll tell you geographically what sorts of soil are in different areas. They also make different interpretations. So is it good for building houses? Is it good for septic system? Would it be good for parks or recreation areas, trails, and that sort of thing? Oh gosh, there's innumerable different interpretive values that we can figure out after we make our initial look at, you know, what the physical, chemical, and so forth properties of that soil are.
Is it just for soil, or does it map other things like, say, forest or, you know, wetlands?
So traditionally, we have just done soil surveys. So they're, depending on what age of soil survey you get and what age of soil survey you're looking at and what probably what the different stakeholders were interested in. We do soil surveys and we also do eco site surveys. And that does also look at the, you know, what the plant community is going on there. And there's different interpretive values that can go along with that, you know, for wildlife management and what kind of animals and things like that you might expect you would find in those areas. So yes, some of our soil surveys are focused just on soils. Some of our soil surveys have that ecosite component to them. And those ecosites are also correlated to, or there's a direct relationship between a type of soil and a specific ecosite.
Is this available online?
It is online. If you just go to Web Soil Survey, boy, that's a whole different talk. I could do just an hour on Web Soil Survey. Yeah, you can select it from either the soil survey area that you might be interested in. For you guys, it would be probably like the Western Kenai, but there's a map there, so you can like zoom in on the map and actually select out your specific farm or your specific garden plot or whatever and find out what kind of soil would exist under there.
Anything else that you would like to say?
Basically, if you would like to find out more information about soil health or any of our other programs, you can visit www.nrcs.usda.gov. And from there, you should be able to find links that will lead you to soil health or how to contact any of our local field offices, which is where you would be going to get the help.
All right. Well, take care.
All right. Well, yeah, like I say, thanks again, and keep in touch if you have any other things that you want to hear about, and we will see what we can do.
Sounds great. And that was Dennis Mulligan, soil scientist for the NRCS USDA State Office. That interview was recorded on May 18, 2020. Up next, your weekly roundup of events and opportunities in local agriculture.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of news and tidbits in local agriculture and wild habitat too. First up, Homer Seed Library's online classes. Thanks to a generous grant from the Homer Foundation, the Homer Seed Library's lead curator, Saskia Esslinger, is offering free one-hour online classes to the public on seed saving and related topics this spring. Upcoming classes include, on May 25th, Intermediate Seed Saving, on June 1st, Advanced Seed Saving, and on June 8th, Gardening with Children. To register for these free classes, visit www.teachgardening.com and click the Homer Seed Library tab up at the top. If you missed some of the other classes from this series, including Beginning Seed Saving and No-Dig Gardening, you can request links to the recorded sessions. Email Saskia at alaskasaskia@gmail.com. And did you know that Homer's Own Oceanside Farms has a YouTube channel? That's right. Local farmers Don McNamara and Donna Ray Faulkner of Oceanside Farms have been filming instructional videos as part of their work mentoring beginning farmers from Kodiak Island tribes. They've made these great little videos available for anyone to view on their new YouTube channel launched this winter. Video topics include a composting tutorial, produce processing, and several on caring for and pruning fruit trees, how and where to plant them, and fruit trees and berries that may do well on Kodiak. To check them out, just search for Oceanside Farms on YouTube, and if you like them, hit the subscribe button to give Donna Ray kudos for making these for people in our area. And lastly, this one's for both farmers and local commercial fishermen. This year, the USDA announced $92.2 million in grants that develop, coordinate, and expand direct producer-to-consumer marketing, local and regional food markets, and local food enterprises. Much of this funding is available to the seafood sector. These include the Farmers Market Promotion Program and the Local Food Promotion Program. Projects under the Farmers Market Promotion Program support direct-to-consumer markets like farmers markets and community-supported agriculture options, or CSAs. Projects under the Local Food Promotion Program support indirect-to-consumer markets like food hubs and value-added product incubators. In this past year, selling wild-caught seafood through CSA subscriptions has rapidly caught on with fishermen in Alaska and other parts of the country, especially as restaurant sales dropped off last year. Some fishermen have collaborated with farmers to include seafood options in their CSA farm boxes, a win for both types of producer. The Local Catch Network, a national organization that supports small fleet fishermen who are interested in selling direct to consumer, organized a virtual question and answer session to discuss both of these grant programs, eligibility requirements, the application process, and technical assistance offered by the Local Catch Network for potential applicants. This live Q&A session happened yesterday, but interested folks can request a link to the recording. The information shared there should be relevant to both farm and fishery producers or anyone looking to build up local and regional food systems. Visit the Local Catch Network website at www.localcatch.org to contact them about the recording. And for anyone interested in getting a CSA seafood subscription, Catch 49 is one such option available locally and is managed by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. You can check it out on their website.
And just a few more things to add. Next Saturday, May 29th, is the first day of the Homer Farmers Market. I heard a rumor that the crafters are back. So go out and support some farmers and some local artisans. We are almost at the year anniversary of the first Homer-grown show that ever aired, and a lot has changed since then, just in how I view the soil. If you want to learn more about the soil, I suggest you revisit episode number 2 of Homer-grown, available on KBBI's website, where my past self admits to thinking that soil is boring. I want to play a short clip of me reacting this year to the subject of soil systems and classifications.
Okay, and then next time we'll do one on soil taxonomy. And
oh, then we can yes! fill it up with... I want to thank Dennis Mulligan for talking to us about soil health. Thank you to Jessica Sharp from Homer Soil and Water for illuminating the soil testing process. As always, thank you to my co-producer, Nicole Arevalo from Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Do you like this background music? Well, you can support the artists. Every member of this band lives in Homer and either works in the fishing industry or in agriculture. So not only are they providing you with music, they are also bringing the food too. You can find them on Bandcamp. They are Trial and Terror. If you appreciate this show, support our underwriters and let them know that you appreciate their support. Questions, comments, and corrections can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. My name is Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer, at 3939 Lake Street, and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777.